Good morning, everyone. Welcome to another day here at the Damage Report. I'm John Iadarola. I woke up this morning. Politics haven't yet gone away, and so neither can we. But thankfully, today we have a secret weapon joining us at almost the last moment. Ravonna herself. Ravonna, how's it going?
I'm good. I'm a little under the weather, so I'm hoping we have some stories that can make me feel better, but I'm sure that we'll have a lot that are going to make me feel much worse.
No, I'm sure we've got some good news. Anyway, no, but what we do have is a lot of interesting stuff, and we're going to start things off a little bit light. George Santos decided to try once again to be interviewed about the massive string of lies that he's told. And man, that guy's really bad at this. It's pretty hilarious to see him flail around on TV. So we're gonna do that and then jump into far more important things, including the impending showdown on the future of Joe Biden's student loan debt cancellation plan. We've got that. Donald Trump talking substance kind of when it comes to his plans for crime. So prepare for that. It's a wild ride. And maybe a little bit of good news for sanity, in that there's a sort of like a test group talking about their thoughts and feelings about Donald Trump. And it seems like his shtick might be wearing off a little bit, but we'll debate that as we go forward. In advance of all that, please hit the like button, share the stream so the people know we're live. And if you want to reach us with any tweets, comments, super chats, interesting thoughts, funny little quips, a chance at a Blue Apron gift card, you can do that. And Ravonna and I will respond as we go. But with all that said, Ravonna, are you ready to start the show?
I'm so ready. Let's do it.
Okay, let's jump right into this.
I think a part of your process, of the cathartic process of redemption, if you like, it's got to start from, I've been a terrible liar. I mean, would you be prepared to say that?
Sure. Like I said, well, I've been a terrible liar on on those subjects. And what I tried to convey to the American people is, I made mistakes of allowing the pressures of what I thought needed to be done in order to, this wasn't about tricking anybody. This wasn't about, it's.
Yes, it was.
No, let me finish.
The whole thing was about tricking people.
Let me finish. It wasn't about tricking the people. This was about getting accepted by the party.
I mean, it might have been about that second thing, but I think it was about the first thing too. I think tricking people is kind of one of the core parts of a lie. What a ridiculous thing to say. I mean, I stabbed the guy, but this wasn't about making people bleed. Come on. This was about doing the thrusting motion I thought was demanded of me.
He's lying for love of the game is what it is.
The love of the game. Yeah, it's not about the effect. It's the thrill it gives me. I get a rush. So he's now had a couple of months, George Santos, to come up with a good explanation as to why he has told some of the most horrendous, brazen, random, horrific lies we've heard in politics. And the argument he's come up with is, it wasn't about tricking you people. It was about tricking like Kevin McCarthy and Mitch McConnell or something. Ravonna, what do you think?
It's interesting because I think the party was fully aware of his lies. Like, I would be shocked if they didn't do any research into this candidate that they were, you know, uplifting. But I mean, it's so silly to say it's not about tricking people. Everybody, why else lie? Like I said, it's not for love of the game. You're lying to deceive people, specifically the voters, particularly his specific lies of his, like being Jewish to appeal to a Jewish voting base, or his credentials to appear like he's qualified for the position. It's not like he was just lying in back rooms to people like Kevin McCarthy. He was lying all up and down the campaign trail, and not just for this last campaign, but for his first campaign before that. So it's, I mean, it's so ridiculous, but I don't know what I would expect from him. I did like him stumbling to answer the question, considering how much time he's had to prepare like a coherent, well-articulated response. And he was just sort of bumbling in his answer to Piers Morgan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Piers Morgan not being the worst for once. You love to see it,
I guess. Rare occasion.
Rare occasion. But yeah, look, if there was good evidence that this explanation was true, let's say that he was, it turned out that he had just viciously lied to the party in interviews, or maybe like he lied to like the New York Times editorial board to get their endorsement or something. Like, but then like he was perfectly honest with the voters or whatever. Then, look, I'm not saying that would be great, but I think a lot of people would be understanding. It's ridiculous what you need to do, what you need to qualify as for the party to support you. You know, on the Democratic side, for instance, you have to not be remotely progressive or else they will banish you to the center of the sun. Like lying to get around that sort of stuff, I think maybe is a noble lie. But lying about you being Jewish, lying multiple times about your mom dying in the towers, like this is just sick stuff. This is not about the party. This is about some sort of festering rot inside your soul, dude.
Yeah, I want to know like what, you know, party bigwig was like needed the convincing to make George Santos the candidate that his mom died in 9/11. Like who was that to sway over to your side within the Republican Party? That's just such a ridiculous lie.
Yep, 100%. Well, look, there was a bit of follow up on this, his credibility going forward. Let's jump to that.
What's funny about falsely claiming you're Jewish?
No, not falsely claiming I'm Jewish. I'd always say I was raised Catholic, but I come from a Jewish family, so that makes me Jewish.
But again,
it's always been a party favor. Everybody's always laughed. And now that everybody's canceling me, everybody's pounding down for a pound of flesh.
Because you're not Jewish.
Well, I never said I was.
Said you were.
And I would always say, but my grandparents are Jewish on my mother's side, so I'm Jewish. Mm. That was always a joke. Everybody used to laugh it up. I said it to a room with 1,000 people in November. People were hysterically laughing. It was funny to them. They loved it.
I don't think Jewish people find it funny.
They were Jewish. I was in a room with the Republican Jewish
coalition.
Do you think
Jewish people find it funny that a US congressman who's a Catholic with no apparent background of any Jewish heritage whatsoever, other than you say you have it, no one can find it. I think a lot of Jewish people would find that offensive.
I beg differ when we were at the RJC in November.
I mean, they thought it was funny. I mean, you know, he once used the N-word and people didn't complain. So I guess that's okay too. Like, we still get to have an issue with it. Or in this particular case, I would say that Jewish people get to decide if they have an issue with that. It doesn't matter if like someone thought it was funny. By the way, what a ridiculous comparison to make. He's in a room with people who understand that he's gonna advocate for the economic policies they want or whatever his platform is. They desperately want him to beat the Democrat that they find to be evil. This is a Republican group of people. The fact that they're okay with something, is that the most unbiased group you can come up with? And that's even accepting that this actually happened. I don't know why I'm accepting at face value a claim that George Santos would make, but I'm even willing to say maybe a group of Republican Jewish voters did laugh at it. That doesn't make it awesome. He could have told his lies about his mom dying on 9/11 and a bunch of conspiracy theorists might have thought that that was hilarious. That doesn't make it a cool thing to say.
I also like the idea that a group of Jewish people would laugh hysterically at the Jew-ish joke as if they've never heard that a million times before in their lives. But it's also just so insidious to be, I don't think he ever said he practiced Judaism, to be fair. But he did say that his grandparents escaped the Holocaust from Ukraine, which is not true, not even a little bit. And there's no evidence to support that his grandparents are Jewish at all. So he did lie and he did it and he, you know, sort of shoots himself in the foot there. He did do it to appeal to the voters because he used that line in front of a group of Jewish Republican voters. So, I mean, that sort of undermines his entire argument from the first clip that we played.
Yeah, and also again, I don't know why we're like engaging seriously, but let's say that they laughed. Maybe they thought it was founded in truth. Like that would influence whether they'd laugh if you're lying to them or not.
Did you not think people would find this out?
You know, Pierce, not after
You're not running to be like a reality TV star.
No, I understand.
Right? You know, if you were going on Celebrity Apprentice, which I went on, right? It doesn't matter. You can embellish stuff about yourself. Nobody cares, right? But to run for Congress of the United States and to just tell blatant lies about even your academic record, I'm just struck, not necessarily that a politician would lie, but that you would think no one would find out.
Well, I'll humor you this. I ran in 2020 for the same exact seat for Congress, and I got away with it then. And I guess.
Right. Well, that's honest.
Stupid.
So you thought actually they're not going to find out?
No, I didn't think so.
That's amazing.
I mean, Piers Morgan is right. He was at least honest about, I got away with it before. I didn't think they'd catch me this time.
You know, that's true. I have to say, now that I've experienced his honesty, go back to lying. Your honesty's crazy, man. As crazy as your lying was, your honesty is weirder. Man, it is honest. That is actually, I guess, why he thought he could get away with it. It isn't fundamentally an answer to the question, because why did you lie the first time, you weirdo? That just begs a further question. But yeah, like, yeah, I scammed all of you morons once. Why wouldn't I think I could do it again? Is honest. It also, by the way, undercuts the whole I desperately needed to do this so the party would take me seriously thing. You were already a prior candidate. Why did you continue lying after that? You had whatever cred it was that you needed. But it's just so sociopathic. Like, why did you kill that woman? Well, I've buried like 5 women before and y'all never caught me. Now you're weirded out by the most recent one. Why did you cheat on me? I've been cheating on you for a while and you are dense, baby. You never know what I'm doing. These are not good answers to the questions being posed to you.
No, but it is a huge, mark against the Democratic Party in New York, because they had not one, but two full campaign cycles to do any oppo research into George Santos, to realize that he has created a fictitious candidate and is running as a facade. I mean, it wasn't even until after he won the seat that we realized, and then it was reported on, that he completely fabricated his entire resume and his entire life story. And it didn't seem like it took those journalists that much research or work to do it. So what is the Democratic Party's excuse? They could have won that district.
Yeah, potentially. And hopefully next time around they will, but it could definitely still matter over the next 2 years. So here's what I'm gonna say. I'm giving this advice purely as a thought experiment. I don't know that it would work, and I wouldn't want George Santos to pursue this even if it, like, whether it would or not. But if, and this is me speaking as a person who does not routinely tell lies, and someone who at least I'm not diagnosed as a sociopath. So, you know, we come from different, you know, ways of thinking. But if I had been caught telling these sorts of lies, I wanted to continue in office, which maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. My thought process would be, okay, I clearly have a problem. And this is what I would say. This is not, I lied to the party or it was one or two things. No, like, I seriously had a problem. Each lie I told that wasn't discovered gave me like rewards for it. I was incentivized to lie more, and lies built on lies until I didn't even recognize myself. My friends didn't know who I was. And it sickens me that I deceived so many people. So here is what I pledge to you. I, in the same way that someone might go to AA or something like that and swear off all alcohol, I am going to practice radical honesty. I will not lie no matter what you ask of me. And if you find that I do, then boot my ass out of Congress. But I'm gonna be the truth teller that Congress has always needed and has rarely had. Maybe that could save his reputation, but he's barely even trying. This strategy is not gonna stop Republican challengers the next time around. It's probably not gonna stop the Democrats from taking this spot. He just needs to think way bigger. And for a guy who's willing to claim that he produced the Spider-Man Broadway show, you'd think he could think outside of the box.
I'll just say, George Santos, just my little bit of advice to you. There's a really good film from 1999. It's called Larry Boy and the Rumor Weed. It's a VeggieTales movie, and it's all about how little lies grow bigger and bigger. Check it out. You might learn something.
I haven't seen that one. That's a gap in my cinematic history. Okay, I'm gonna have to watch that. And so will George Santos. Okay, with that said, why don't we move on to other developing news? A group of student loan borrowers are apparently preparing to boycott or picket outside of the Supreme Court, basically make their presence felt in anticipation of this coming showdown on the future of Biden's student debt cancellation. They say they, quote, want to make sure that the justices look into the eyes of borrowers, which I think is an admirable goal. And they should do it. They should definitely do it. As many people as possible should show up, and you should help to amplify and signal boost what they're doing. My prediction would be that they will not get what they want in terms of the justices actually looking them in the eye. We're peasants. We're nothing to these justices. They don't care about us. They're not interested in our well-being. They're ideologues, like any right-wing pundit, any elected official. It's the exact same thing. They just wear different clothes. That's all it is. That doesn't mean that for sure the Supreme Court is going to destroy this thing, and we want to prepare you for how the process will unfold. But first, Max Lubin is the CEO and co-founder of Rise, which is a student and youth-led group trying to make higher education free for all. Says, I think that when people see who is impacted, if they themselves are not, they start to understand that this is about fairness and this is about opportunity and not ruining someone's life with decades of unpayable debt just because you're trying to earn an education. And we're reaching like the big week on this, because on the 28th of February, the Supreme Court is gonna be hearing two different cases that are seeking to utterly destroy this entire cancellation plan. You have the first, Nebraska v. Biden, brought by six conservative state attorneys general that say the Biden administration is overstepping its authority. The second was brought by a conservative advocacy group for two individuals, one who does not qualify for the forgiveness plan, and one who does not qualify for $20,000, like the full amount that some will be eligible for. And there are massive problems at the ground floor on both of these cases. The first being that the argument the attorneys general are making is that because some people might be incentivized to refinance their loans under something that would not generate tax revenue for the state, ipso facto, the states might lose money, maybe in some cases. But as bad as that is, the other one, a person who doesn't qualify, well, if I don't qualify, then I will burn the world to ash. Tens of millions should be burdened by student debt cancellation because I can't get it. But even that person, I think, holds a position of moral superiority to the person who qualifies for some, but not all of it, and says, well, thus, nobody should get anything. I mean, these are, look, I don't know these people. I don't know their psychology. My guess would be they want a life in right-wing politics, which is why they're willing to do this. But they're gonna be hearing both of these, and we've got six insane radical ideologues on the Supreme Court who might be willing to destroy this thing, regardless of how blatantly legal it is. Rivana, what do you think?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right that these are people who want careers in right-wing politics. You know, these organizations choose their plaintiffs really carefully in their cases. I will say that I think appealing to the, I like the argument that looking someone in the face who is going through a struggle might help you realize that there is a victim of this and empathize with them for a real human being. But I don't see the Supreme Court justices as human beings. They're the nine unelected wizards that get to decide everything that happens to us in our country. And they are, most six of them at least, are just puppets of the Federalist Society. And I mean, appealing to a judge's emotions can work sometimes, but I mean, I had a client who had to crawl up and down the stairs. This was a 12-year-old boy, had to crawl up and down the stairs at his school because he was a wheelchair user and they had no elevator. The judge cried while he was giving his testimony and then ruled against us. So I mean, really anything can happen, but wow. I am, even as a student debt holder, I would qualify for the $20,000 forgiveness. I have $100,000 in student loan debts. I'm about to graduate in May. Super concerning, but I don't have high hopes for this. I think that the Supreme Court is gonna do whatever the Federalist Society tells them to do. It says dance, they dance, it says jump, they say how high. So we'll just have to wait and see, yeah. But I would taper your expectations if you are hoping for them to rule for the loan holders.
We're gonna have to see. The Biden lawyers are saying that in both cases, the challenges don't have sufficient standing to claim an actual like financial injury as a result of this. But that's all like legalese.
Yeah, I mean,
that's like a weapon you would use if the battlefield was an honest, intellectually like an honest argument about the merits. Well, no, I think that Amy Coney Barrett and Kavanaugh are going to be like, they're going to be like in an old library, like when Gandalf goes to Gondor to find out about the ring. And they're going to be like going through dusty tomes and like, what is it exactly? That's probably what's going to happen.
But the Biden administration is 100% right, in my opinion. They have no standing, but standing doesn't exist anymore. The Supreme Court ruled on a case. Yeah, I mean, they ruled in favor of on a case of like in industries when it comes to the environment about a hypothetical theoretical law that could be passed years and years in the future, which shouldn't make them have standing. But they said to damn with precedent, to damn with standing, we'll do whatever you want.
100%. And by the way, this was always a possibility, especially with the dire state of the Supreme Court. But Biden was right to do it anyway. Advocate and fight for the people. And if the other side wants to be utter demons, then let them. And if the Supreme Court knocks this down, you make sure there isn't a person in this country that doesn't know that they did it, why they did it, who put them on the Supreme Court, and who's trying to become president again to put more utter ghouls and troglodytes on the Supreme Court just like them. And then you do executive orders and executive actions to do whatever it is that you can to help people and let them fight against that too. Fight on this battlefield where you are advocating for the people and actually trying to solve their problems while the other side is trying to keep them burdened by debt for the rest of their lives. It sucks that we're in this position, but if we are in this position, and we are, at the very least prove that you can be the warrior we need.
If that student debt planned by Biden had been universal and erased all student loan debt, that second lawsuit would be moot, by the way. Just wanted to point that out. They would have no argument there if it was given to everyone. So thanks, Biden. Well,
you'd still have the attorneys general, and then you'd probably have someone who was like, but I didn't go to college because there was possibly debt. And it'd be like, yes, I understand that. I understand the world is not perfectly fair. Thank you for letting us know that. And I will remind people, as I have, you know, back into the years where we were advocating for this to happen. I had student loan debt. I wasn't burdened by as much perhaps as like Rayvanna right here, but I had, I don't know, $35,000, $40,000 of student loan debt. I went to UConn. It's not that expensive. What I did is, as soon as I could, I started paying off literally every cent that I could. I lived like a hermit's life for years just to pay it off. Don't do that, by the way, financially. It was a bad idea. I should have invested the money instead. I don't have any student loan debt, and I haven't had student loan debt for years. I still desperately want everyone else who can be relieved of it to be relieved of it. And that is the only rational way to approach this. In any event, with that said, we're gonna take our first break. I have more thoughts about some of the interesting research that's been done into the people who have applied for student debt cancellation. It is not who you might have thought, some of the attacks against cancellation. I'm gonna be making a video and putting it up on the Damage Reports TikTok a little bit later on today. So stay tuned for that. We got more news coming up after this.
Joe Biden and the defund the police Democrats have turned our once great cities into cesspools of bloodshed and crime. There's never been anything like it.
You know, we can't go one day without Joe Biden calling to defund the police. It's just defund the police, get rid of the military, radical old wacky Joe Biden and all that. Donald Trump wants this election to be about law and order because he thinks that if he terrifies enough people, then that's a good battlefield to him wages war on. He's not interested in the facts either. First of all, the police were not defunded. They weren't defunded even by a little bit, literally anywhere. Is there more crime than there was a few years back? Yes. I'll remind you, we're like 3 years into a pandemic. It's caused a few issues. I will also remind you that there were some of us who wanted policies to be enacted that could have probably allayed quite a bit of that increase in crime. I will also remind you that when Donald Trump says we've never seen anything like this before, that is very much not the case. There is far, far less crime than there was for decades and decades in America. But you would only know that if you cared to look, I suppose. Rayvanna, what do you think?
I mean, John, I think you're completely wrong. I live in Chicago, a city where we have defunded the police. I heard Tucker Carlson say it. I've heard all the Republicans running for office in the state say it. So it must be true, despite the fact that the police budget increased significantly during this last year. But no, I mean, it is silly. And you're exactly right. Like, they are claiming that, you know, crime is on the rise, but the rise is tiny. And in comparison to crime rates in the 80s and the 90s, it is so, so significantly down. And again, no evidence that funding the police more would decrease crime, because they've been funding the police more and more and more every year. And there was a rise in crime from last year to this year. So funding the police didn't work. I mean, I wouldn't expect him to be accurate or have the facts in front of him, or even give a crap if he did have the facts in front of him, or be able to read them if they were in front of him. But it would just be nice for someone to be honest. So I guess that's what we're doing.
Maybe if they were written in Sharpie, it's possible. No, but I'm glad that you mentioned that, because, by the way, again, not disputing that in some areas there is more crime. And if you've been affected by it, then that matters. And so Biden or whoever the candidate ends up being needs to speak to that. My issue is simply acknowledging that there is in some areas more crime doesn't mean, and thus Donald Trump is the guy to put in office. Again, as Ravana points out, it makes no sense to put him in office if your priority is crime, if the things he's gonna do aren't gonna lower crime. Why would you do that? Why just waste billions of dollars and not actually improve the situation? I'll remind you, there's more crime in America after 4 years of Trump than there were before the 4 years of Trump. So it seems insane to think that just putting him back into office is gonna fix things. That said, maybe he has some interesting ideas. Maybe they're novel and new and outside of the box thinking. Let's see some of what he's proposing.
I will insist that local jurisdictions return to proven common sense policing measures, such as stop and frisk. Very simple. You stop them and you frisk them. We will go after the radical Marxist prosecutors who are abolishing cash bail, refusing to charge crimes, and surrendering our cities to violent criminals. They have surrendered like never before. I will direct the DOJ to open civil rights investigations into radical left prosecutors' offices, such as those in Chicago, LA, and San Francisco, to determine whether they have illegally engaged in race-based enforcement of the law.
I mean, that is an amazing little 180 there. So what we need is more stop and frisk. We should be doing, which we know is one of the most racist policies ever instituted by the police. That's what it was designed to do, and that is in fact literally what it did. Also, by the way, I wonder if they've done race-based policing. He obviously wants them to do race-based policing. He just has a certain idea of which races should be targeted and which should not, which I'm sure you're all shocked by. Ravana?
I think it's funny because he says, you know, we need to open investigations into the race-based prosecution in Chicago. And if you did, you would find some. You would find a hell of a lot of race-based prosecution in Chicago. Not the way he thinks, though, because he's implying that they're not charging black people who are committing crimes, when in fact, black people are significantly more likely to be charged with a crime, even when they're statistically just as likely as white people to commit that crime. Or, you know, white people who are caught by the police committing a crime, less likely to be charged than a black person who's caught by the police committing a crime. And I'll just also add, because he says they're abolishing cash bail, he's talking about Illinois. He claims that it was prosecutors in Chicago who abolished cash bail. It was our legislator. They passed a bill, voted on it. It was signed by the governor. And we had a gubernatorial election where that exact law was on the line. That was the entire platform of the Republican candidate who was running against J.B. Pritzker, was standing against that law. He was campaigning on saying, I'm not going to let it go into effect. And he lost, dramatically lost. So we had, you know, essentially a referendum on whether or not the people of the state support that law. And they said, hell yeah, we do. So, I mean, it's ridiculous, but yeah, prosecutors aren't eliminating cash bail. Legislators are eliminating cash bail. People are doing it on their ballots. It's a popular initiative. It has nothing to do with doing crime either. Like, people aren't less likely to do a crime because cash bail exists or not. They're just more likely to be forced to stay in pretrial detention, where you know, they might be the victims of a crime in prison, or they're more likely to confess falsely to a crime because they're being broken down by our broken judicial prison systems.
Yeah, 100%. No, I think the reason that he says something like that is, first of all, his base is has been trained to believe that anyone who has interacted with the police is obviously guilty. So were they to get out? No, you've released a criminal, not someone who's been alleged to have done something. That's a monster, and you've let them out. Also, Donald Trump is obviously a right-wing populist, so a statement wouldn't be good enough unless it explicitly advocated for more rights going to the richest among us. They should be allowed to leave after they've been charged with a crime, but you poors should rot in a lockup. It's weird that they don't notice the pattern here. But anyway, some of the stuff that he's calling for, obviously he's been calling for, you know, executions to come back, public executions, filmed executions, mass executions, just a lot of crazy stuff. But he also has some fairly novel ideas for solving certain types of crime. Let's take a look at this.
I will order the Department of Justice, or some people call it the Department of Injustice right now, and Homeland Security dismantle every gang, street crew, and drug network in America. Every single one of them will be dismantled. We already know where these turf wars and drug dens are. We know who the people are. And we're going to charge them and charge the culprits with every crime that we can find.
Look, I have been trying with our coverage to prepare people for what the next year and a half or so is going to be like during this presidential election. And that comes in multiple forms, making sure that you understand that it's going to be horrific in a lot of ways. A lot of the rhetoric that you're going to be hearing from Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis is going to get so wildly transphobic and racist and misogynistic that I need you to prepare yourself for that. But you also need to prepare yourself for how utterly ridiculous it's going to be. I'm going to shut down all the gangs because we know where they are and who they are is so stupid. He was president for almost half a decade. Why didn't he do it? Why would Biden love? Why? How could anyone buy this as a serious solution to gang activity across America? I don't know, but these are simple-minded people that he has gathered around him, and some of them are going to love this stuff.
It's so awesome for him to sit there and say, I know where all the gangs are. I've known where they all are. Chose not to do anything about it for 4 years, but this time around, I promise you, I'll do it. Which is why I think this election is going to be super interesting, because he's not running for a second term as an incumbent. Whereas if he was, this would be the time where he's announcing these policies and passing executive orders and making these decisions and saying, you know, we're going to start initiating these programs. That's why you should vote for me, as opposed to I will do these programs, when we can look back at the path, the from 2016 to 2020 when he didn't do it, and just say, but you didn't do it then. Yeah. So, and you can't do it now because you're, you know, not a politician. You're just, you know, golfing up Mar-a-Lago and interrupting people's weddings there. But like, so why should we believe that you would do it in the future? And because that's how you have to appeal to his base in that sense, because you can't just say it's a stupid idea because they think it's a great idea, but just point out to them, hey, he didn't do it though.
Yeah, he did not do that. And it's understandable that he didn't, because it's crazy.
Yeah.
Hold on really fast. Heatwood Max says in the chat, same vibes as class president, pizza day will be every day. It has big pizza day policy vibes. I will grant you that. Okay, we're gonna move on to our next block, talk about this just briefly. Whenever we're ready, why don't we jump into this first video.
What is the one emotion that you feel the most when you see former President Trump on TV or on your device?
You know, I like Trump, I voted for Trump, but I'm concerned with electability, you know, his chances of getting elected. And, you know, a lot of people aren't like us in this room. And if he comes across as, you know, on Twitter as a little bit not tactful with the way he goes about saying his message, it just concerns, you know, I don't want to see a Democrat elected. So I'm concerned about the way he delivers his message. I agree with his message. I'm just concerned about the way it's delivered.
So we just saw is a little bit of a focus group of Republican primary voters, basically all of whom at one point or another have supported Donald Trump, some of which loved Donald Trump. But now, as we get up into the beginnings of this Republican primary for the 2024 presidential race, there's some concerns. And they really do come in two forms. You saw that guy talk about his electability. There he's talking about whether he'd be able to beat a Democrat. That's a problem, but I don't think it's a problem Donald Trump is too worried about. He wants to be the nominee. He'll deal with Biden when he gets to him or whatever. The bigger issue for Donald Trump in this focus group is that they seem to be souring on him in comparison to other Republicans. So Angela, 53-year-old, said, "That's a hard one. That's a hard one." Just because of the way they've done him, she spoke of Trump's opponents who had tried to hurt him both in office and since he left the White House, quote, "It's more of an embarrassment for him for what they put through. I feel embarrassed for him." I bet you feel embarrassed. And I bet it's totally just for him, not of him or your support of him. Two people picked pride and hopeful as what they feel when they see Trump. So that's good news for him. But the rest had other words: anxious, neutral, frustrated, nervous, overwhelmed, fatigue, embarrassed, annoyed, and maddening. One, Nancy, said, "The current Trump is not the Trump that I voted for. I feel like he has shown some things, qualities and non-qualities, whatever, that I don't care for now." I don't know what a non-quality you don't care for would be, but I'm not even faulting her. She just means there's something about him that I do not like, and that comes through. They did sessions with 14 different voters to profile of them, and among them, half of them said, "No, I'm gonna vote for Governor Ron DeSantis." What do you think, Rivana?
I love this because the overwhelming like consensus of what they're saying is that we think Trump's kind of pathetic, and I like it for petty reasons, because I know that that would hurt him a lot. Like, that's the one thing in the world he doesn't want to appear as, is pathetic or someone you should be embarrassed for. He wants to be big and strong and a leader, but they're like, "Oh, the way they did him was so wrong. I just, you know, I feel sorry for him. He's a sad guy. He's not the president." It's like, it's true. He is pathetic. But some of their criticisms are like, you know, "Oh, he's not tactful enough." Oh, was he tactful in 2016 when you full-heartedly supported him? Was that tact? Because, oh my God, the bar is in hell.
Yeah, I just want to go back to classic Trump when, you know, he didn't want to offend anyone or rock the boat. He would just say like, "Mexicans, rapists, let me tell you." No, it's not real. It's not about tact, really. They love the insane, absurd, racist, and misogynistic things he would say. They're worried that he won't be able to get it done, and they should be. He lost in 2020, and this is also, I think, broadcasting or telegraphing that probably most of those people would say that the election was stolen from him, and he totally won. But if you really believe that, then you'd be more confident of his chances in 2024. Some of these people will say he got robbed, but deep within their heart, they know he lost and they're worried that he would lose again. And they should be worried about it. Look, I've said before, I will say again, at least as of right now, and I reserve the, you know, the right to change my opinion. What I want is a long drawn out Republican primary where Donald Trump makes Ron DeSantis look like a little baby, because that's gonna be hilarious and hopefully it ruins his career. Ron DeSantis attacks Donald Trump and forces him to say a bunch of crazy stuff that'll poison the general election for him. And then he gets destroyed in 2024, preferably by a progressive replacement for Joe Biden. If we can get all of that, it's gonna be a great couple of years for me. Hopefully you'll join us. We'll have some chuckles along the way. So I don't know, when I see this stuff about how he might get beaten by Ron DeSantis, I think it's gonna make for an interesting race, Rayvana. I still think he is fully equipped to like burn Ron DeSantis down to his constituent atoms. But what do you think?
He's already soft launching that, right? Because he said that when Ron DeSantis asked for his endorsement when he was running for governor, that Ron DeSantis was crying on the phone to him and he made him look pathetic. Mm-hmm. And I think you're right, because I think DeSantis is in a weird position where he's going to have to attack Trump a lot, especially when they get on the debate stage. It's gonna be nasty. And DeSantis is gonna lose a lot of favor with a lot of Republicans when he does it. These, you know, Trump diehard supporters aren't gonna like that. So I think at the end, Trump will be the nominee, and then I wishful thinking he won't win an election. But yeah, it's going to be really nasty. And the attacks against one another are definitely going to damage their reputations. And then, you know, even if Ron DeSantis becomes the candidate, you know, if he's been torn to shreds by Trump on the debate stage, that's going to stick, right? When we come into the general election. So best case scenario, the Republican Party self implodes.
Yeah. Best case scenario. And a progressive takes the presidency as a result of it to reign over the ashes. Anyway, with that said, we need to take a break. When we come back, Bernie Sanders has some thoughts on the future of political media in America. We're going to let you know what he thinks after this.
Do you worry when you talk about the corporate media that you are targeting journalists when you say that?
No. Donald Trump talks about fake news, and that's simply to deflect attention from the fact that he's a pathological liar. My experience one-on-one with media, they work hard. They very rarely am I misquoted. But what I am talking about, Margaret, is that corporate media limits the kind of debate that we have in this country. Mm-hmm. You tell me, you know more about it than I do. How often do we talk about income and wealth inequality?
We're talking about right now, Senator.
Yeah, but how often? Not everybody is Bernie Sanders on your show. How often do you talk about concentration of ownership? How often do you talk about the fact that we are the only major country on earth not to guarantee healthcare at all, and yet we spend twice as much money? How often do you talk about that if somebody has a baby in Finland, they're getting 9 months off or 10 months off paid family leave?
I will talk to you about paid leave for families any day of the week. They also have like a 56% tax rate in Finland, though. It's a very different system. But
good, but let's talk about it. What do they get for that? They get free healthcare, right? Mm-hmm. Free higher education? That's the kind, that's exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
That's the debate I want, and that's the debate we really don't have on the corporate media.
Okay, so there were some great points raised in that. That's why I'm so glad that Bernie Sanders will go on adversarial media like Face the Nation. They talked about some of the stuff, and it's good. But I do want to focus a bit on the framing. Margaret Brennan there saying, do you think that when you talk about the corporate media, you're targeting journalists? Like the idea being that this is in any way comparable to Donald Trump and his fake news and, oh, those people back there, they're censoring you. No, 1,000 times no, we are not gonna accept this sort of framing. Pointing out that much of media is owned by corporations, and that does very much influence what they cover, but especially the things that they don't cover, is so utterly necessary that we cannot allow for a second the conflation of that with people who are trying to demonize journalists individually or as a group and trying to get them killed. We are 1,000% clear that no political violence in any way is acceptable, but criticism of corporate control of media, corporate control of political parties is not nearly talked about enough. So let's just be very clear about that. What do you think, Rivana?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was like a really insidious way to start the interview, just sort of starting off and with a bad faith argument. But I like that he shut that down quickly. I'll also say Finland does not have a 58% tax. I was looking at their income tax brackets just now. The highest tax bracket is 31%, like,
oh, really?
On for income tax. Yeah. So, and the average tax that, you know, the average household would pay in Finland, the percentage is nearly identical to the average tax that the average American would pay. She's talking about, you know, the highest potential tax bracket, which would only impact the wealthy, and that's only taxed on the money they're making in excess of a certain amount. And the one I was looking at said $80,000 or 80,000 euros in Finland. So there's that. So it's just sort of wholly dishonest, but he is right. It's not about the journalists themselves. There's a lot of journalists who work for corporate news outlets that do really good investigative work, and they're not presenting lies. It's about what stories get published, and it's about how, especially when it comes to corporate news channels, what stories are pitched, what stories are produced, what stories are presented to the public, the ability to cover those stories based on who their advertisers are and what they're willing to present, that they're, you know, they're towing that line, right? We don't want to lose this advertiser, so maybe we don't do this story. It's not about the, you know, blatant, when it comes to things like MSNBC or CNN, it's not like blatant dishonesty in the reporting. It's just about what you're choosing to report on and what, more importantly, you're choosing not to report on.
100%, yeah. Yeah, so I'm glad that you fact checked it by that way, because I was perfectly willing to accept that that was a true figure, and I was gonna criticize her for saying to Bernie Sanders of all people, yeah, but do you know that some of these countries in Europe have higher taxes? Yes, he knows. I think that Bernie Sanders knows that, but okay, they're not even that high. I would be fine if they were. And not to get this personal, but I kind of wish that Bernie had flipped it around her and said, let's get real, Mrs. Brennan. Are you terrified at this current moment of losing your home? Are you terrified of not being able to pay for your next medical procedure? Are you, do you have dental coverage? Because a lot of people don't. Are you worried about being able to retire with dignity? No, you, let's be clear, you do not have those fears. And now you are afraid of something. You clearly are afraid of your taxes going up. But isn't it an amazing privileged position to be able to have abstract fears like that? That you are freed up from fears of shelter and food and healthcare and all of those things to worry about abstract stuff like your tax bracket? A lot of people would be so lucky as to have those fears. In the same way that like there's Maslow's like hierarchy of needs, there's a hierarchy of fears, and it's great to have abstract ones to worry about, like, am I making the most of my potential? Man, some people don't have food. So again, it's just there's so much privilege and comfort that is baked into the questions that they ask. They're so utterly comfortable that they're freed up to have these fears that other people would dream of.
Yeah, and just to that point, I mean, as an example, Doctors Without Borders is an organization that we usually picture, you know, going to impoverished countries and providing health services to people with no or extremely limited income and no access to those services. They also do that in West Virginia, in the United States. And there's like dentist groups that'll come in and give dental care for free, you know, every once in a blue moon to people living within the United States. Yep. I mean, these are issues that I'm sure she hasn't ever thought about in her life, but this is a reality for a lot of people here. They're not worried about taxes aside from when is the date I have to file by and do I have TurboTax still downloaded on my phone, right? Or how much money am I going to get back from my taxes? Like low income people, myself included, are always looking forward to our tax returns. We're not concerned about, you know, how much, you know, of our you know, wealth that we've hoarded is being taken away and redistributed for goods and services for, you know, lower income people. So it's just such an unrelatable position, but it does kind of, it seeps its way into the discourse. Like I always use my parents as an example. I mean, we're a low income household. They're in a low tax bracket, but my mom always votes on taxes. They used to be Republicans for a long time and they would always talk about, oh, this is gonna increase taxes. But it's like, your taxes are low. Like this is not an issue for you, but it does, like, just continuing with that message does sort of, it melts its way into the public discourse and it persuades people who wouldn't be impacted negatively by a rise in taxes.
100%. Yeah. And by the way, to take it back to the first point, this isn't about Margaret Brennan. I'm not super familiar with everything that Margaret Brennan says on her show, but she doesn't strike me as one of the worst people in media. She's just a regular person in media who happens on average to be wealthy and secure and comfortable. That's just what they are. And by the way, like, it's not like the only people that can understand or advocate for these things, that can feel a connection to these things, have to be living on the edge. They don't. Bernie Sanders is not worried about dying on the streets in a few months or anything. He's not gonna but he understands it, he tries. I'm not nearly as insecure as I was for most of my life. I spent many, many years desperately worried that one overage charge on my debit card would ruin my month, basically. But you try to see beyond just your concerns, to not accept, like you know, I understand that the concept of being woke or whatever has been purposefully ruined. But the idea that you try to look beyond your current position and try to understand the experiences of other people, if anything, should be one of the number one things that people in media do. I understand that we don't have and we're not gonna have an NBC news anchor or an MSNBC news anchor that makes the minimum wage, you know, or is like a 19-year-old activist. Like they're always gonna choose richer people who've been around for a while, but they can try. Try to understand. That's what I would request. Okay, with that said, that is unfortunately all the time we have for the first hour of our show. Thank you to everyone who joined us for the first hour of the Damage Report. But don't you worry, I know some of you are thinking, that can't be all the news. It's not. There's more stuff. Chill out. We're going to get to the aftermath in just a few. And when we return, we're going to be talking about the ways that Mark Zuckerberg is trying to make sure that Facebook remains worse than Twitter, no matter what happens. We're going to be talking about teen girl sadness and the dumb explanations for it coming from the right wing. And meanwhile, in. We'll see you all in just a few. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.